the famous part of the Holy Man of Faith, how the Rav interprets the two stories of creation and Bereishis. What's particularly interesting is that if it wasn't about the Lonely Man of Faith, and with just a paper about how we understand two stories of creation and Bereishis, it would be almost as famous.
Almost what?
Because it's obvious when you learn, we learn Bereishis, that there are two accounts of creation and two accounts of the creation of man. And it's a major source of biblical criticism. And the religious answer usually is, well, we don't understand anything of Bereishis anyway. So it is whatever it is. And the Rav has a very specific perspective, which really, when it came out, was absolutely astonishing. So we're on section B of the first chapter, I guess, however it's divided. And the Rav points out, it's not different traditions about creation, but it's two descriptions of man. And I've mentioned before, and it will post my the classes I've given on the Rav, that the Rav is a very strong believer in the simultaneous existence of opposites, except he's not Hegelian that says thesis and antithesis leads to synthesis. No, the thesis and the antithesis are both true simultaneously. There's going to be a tension between them, but they reflect different aspects of reality. So what I mean, there's no synthesis, is there's no finding the solution to combine everything. And one of the differences, if you look at it as a dialectic with two different things being true, and that each of us is a composite with some parts of one and some parts of the other, then it allows much greater area for human uniqueness, because we may get different percentages of one and the other. It's not, if you say a synthesis, then we come out in the middle. No, we don't come out in the middle. We come out wherever we come out. We have different natures. Sometimes more this way, sometimes more that way. What is important about this in terms of Bereishis is that since the two accounts both say that Adam was created by God, and in each account he's given a mitzvah, not in the sense of tayag mitzvahs, but he's given a command of what he's supposed to do, we have to assume that we're given both commands, right? Even though they're very different, the commands. So the first says, he goes over four major differences, he said discrepancies, between the two stories, right? So in the first story, it's an English translation, of course. So God created man in his own image, in the image of God, God created him, male and female created he them, which is a very interesting. It starts with one and ends with two, right? But it doesn't talk about, like we have in Bereishis Beis, talking about the second story, that he created man and then from man he created woman. He created two of them, implying that the two, male and female, were created simultaneously. One. All right. And the eternal God formed the man of the dust of the ground and breathed in his nostrils the breath of life, and the man became a living soul. So we have that explicitly that man is a combination of earthly things, right? Comes from the ground. And Hashem gave something, a spirit into him, which implies some kind of godly-like element to human beings, not just natural in the ground. And the eternal God planted a garden eastward in Eden. And the eternal God took the man and placed him in the Garden of Eden. Whoops, I just skipped to the second story. I started with the second story. But what I said is true, it just applied to the second one. Right? Talks about... I shifted from the first to the second. I'm sorry. The first part is true. The first story creates two of Adam and Eve. The second story creates Adam. And then Adam looks for a mate. And from within Adam, Eve is created. In the first story, we're then told, he said it created man in his image. Doesn't mean anything about the part from the ground, right? First, man is in the image of God. How he was formed, we don't know. And the second one, he's a combination of earthly and spiritual. Another distinction is that the first Adam is told, and God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the fowl of the heaven, and of every living thing that creepeth over the earth. That the mission of man is to conquer his environment, right? If he multiplies, means his, the needs are going to go are going to increase, obviously, to provide sustenance for all these people. And he is supposed to conquer it, and he'll have be above all the creatures of the world. In the second case, he's told he planted a garden, and the eternal God took the man and placed him in the Garden of Eden to cultivate it and to keep it. Doesn't say anything about development, right? He should work in the garden, keep it, but he doesn't control it necessarily. Right, so these are the four many discrepancies. Right, the Tzelem Elokim, right, and talks about the nefesh in the second, but not Tzelem Elokim. Milu'as Arzik of Shua against the Sham of the Shamra. And the first story, they're both created. And the second story, Adam is created and the woman Eve from him, which implies a very different relationship, a much more personal relationship. They all come from one. As God created two people, you know, one was male and one was female. And finally, the one that the biblical critics are very fond of noticing, that in the first case you have only Elohim, and the second case is Hashem Elohim. One of the big things of biblical criticism is to provide stories by names of Hashem. We had in the beginning of Noah as well, if you can separate parts of the story with one name and parts with the other, when they come from my name. There are obviously other explanations for the use of different names for Hashem, but that's that. Okay. So he's going to start with Adam the first. All right. What is the image of God mean? All right. So it's very interesting. So the Rav says, we're accustomed to people saying, what's unique about human beings? The power of speech. the Rav thinks what's unique about human beings and in what way we created the image of God in the capacity to be creative, which is very consistent with how the Rav, if in the Isha Halacha of the Rav, when he distinguished with the person he called Isha Das, the religious personality, but then not necessarily the Isha Halacha, it's the intellectual, independent component of the Isha Halacha. In what way is man godlike? We can change the reality. We can be creative. We can change things where everything else is what it is within the framework of how it was created. Right? We're blessed with the great drive for creative activity, immeasurable resources, and realization of the goal. The most outstanding of which is the intelligence, the human mind capable of confronting the outside world and inquiring into its complex working. And the reference at the bottom is the Rambam Mishnah Torah, you saw that Torah. This particular whole essay is written so that someone who knows very little about Jewish sources except for Bereishis can fully understand this. May not catch all the technical words the Rav uses. I had to look up what Hasidic poetic was, but I'm still not sure if I looked them up. It's important only because one of the critiques the Rav makes of biblical criticism is that they use literary characteristics of modern literature. And not thinking that things were done very differently in terms of oral traditions and how things were memorized back, 4,000 years ago. Which is an interesting question on even the religious literary analysis is not being caught up in assuming that it was written in the 20th century with the literary styles of the 20th century. Anyway, now, but the Rav points out, if the goal of having this intelligence is to control nature, so a specific kind of intelligence. It's technological, it's practical, it has consequences in what kind of, by discussing philosophy, I don't control nature. I found discussions, but nothing changes because of my philosophic speculation. But if I'm a scientist, that gives me tools to understand and to create vaccines, right? To improve agriculture, invent machines to do the work that used to be done by hand. It's very technical in scientific knowledge. It's not philosophic knowledge, right? Functional and practical aspects of the intellect through which man is able to gain control of nature. Right? The metaphysical, archaeological, qualitative, it won't do it. He said the Greeks were excelled in philosophy. They weren't particularly good in technology. It's very interesting. A math background. When you learn the Gemara, and even you go to the Tosfos, you try to explain something mathematical, they don't talk about theorems.
About theorems?
Theorems, mathematical theorems. Right? How do you're interested in measuring something, so there was a method of taking an object and get it a different size and trying to fit it in. And you see how many used up. It was very much the method that the Persians used. So they did not contribute that much to theoretical mathematics, but you're certainly good enough for building buildings, right? For measuring things, even if it was done without a theorem. I don't have to know that, you know, the Pythagorean theorem to know what the sides of the triangle add up to. Calculation, just practical knowledge. Okay. One of the differences between medieval science and modern science is you prove by experiment, right? You see what works in modern science. If you can't duplicate the experiment, then you throw the result out. It has to be something that if I did an experiment and you take the materials that I used, you know, same elements, you have to get the same result. Otherwise, it's not a scientific result, not acceptable. So that's very functional, right? You have a practical conclusion. All right. Therefore, Adam the First is interested in just a single aspect of reality and asks one question only. How does the cosmos function? No whys or even whats. Doesn't matter why it's that way. I'm interested in knowing what it is and how I can deal with it, how I can manipulate it, how I can use that knowledge to make something. Why it is speculation. It won't change. If I don't know why it is that way, okay. Why was I created? Irrelevant. I'm here. Right. How do I function? Okay. He's concerned with the question per se with its practical implications. He does not ask a metaphysical but a practical, technical how question. Right? To be precise, his question is related not to the genuine functioning of the cosmos in itself, but the possibility of reproducing the dynamis of the cosmos by employing quantified mathematical media which man evolves through postulation and creative thinking. The Rav is very into mathematics, even though his degree was in philosophy. Why? Because in science, having mathematical equations roots the science. Science is a combination of experiments and getting things into mathematical equations. So, and mathematical, most of math, there's an area in the foundations of mathematics which is different, but mathematics is a way of defining things. And in math, you have to prove it. If you can't prove the theorem, it may seem right, if you want anything. It's not explicitly cognitive. It's by the selfish side of Adam to better his own position in relation to his environment. Adam the First is overwhelmed by one quest, namely to harness and dominate the elemental natural forces and to put them at his disposal. Right? He wants to understand how the world works so that he can learn to use it, to better it, to function better. He wants to make his life better. And if he knows how things work, then he's in position to be creative and duplicate them and make them better. Okay. The practice interests, practical interest arouses will to learn the secrets of nature. He's completely utilitarian as far as the innovation and innovation, technology, teleology, design, methodology, concerned. It's, you know, his results or as someone who studied math, it would seem to theoretical mathematics and practical mathematics. The theoretical math teachers prided themselves that it had no use. But at the end of the day, all the theoretical mathematics ended up having practical use, even though they try to make the distinction. Right. What is the objective in this? Well, the only one is what God placed before him, and that is for man to be himself. He wants to be human, identity which is bound up with humanity. Right. How does he find himself? With a simple equation introduced by the psalmist, proclaimed the singularity and unique station of man in nature. But that was made him a little lower than the angels. Remember this from Shulas Ne'ila, after he said that man is no different than the animals. Then it says, but you made man almost godlike, right? Almost like the angel, and has crowned him with honor or dignity and glory. Now, this is a very interesting part of this, and the footnotes are very important here. The word kavod is used both in positive and negative ways. And when we talk about someone who runs for kavod, it's a disparaging statement. Right? A person wants glory. He wants to be recognized. He wants to get the headlines in the paper. He's famous. On the other hand, we use kavod with respect to Hashem, and we talk about kvod habrios, which means respecting the dignity of man. Right? Even, for example, we know that the halacha is that a talmid chacham shemacha al kvodo kvodo macha. A talmid chacham can say, "Don't honor me." Why? Because in a sense, it's his own Torah. It's not just the Torah God gave him; it becomes his Torah. It's a drasha in the Gemara. Because Hashem chefto v'Torah, so it becomes his Torah. It's his Torah that he can say, "I don't want to be honored for it. It's mine. I own it." However, the din is that you can't be mevazeh him. You can't embarrass him, because that takes away from his basic dignity, and that he can't be. He can't be mocha. Alright, so he talks about this in footnote 4 and 5. He talks about Ocho Meshutel Mekakalev, Kvod Malchuso, Kvod Abrios. Alright. And, you know, in the famous Gemara Brachos, that Kavod Abrios is Dochelos, it says Shabbat Torah. Even though the Gemara modifies it, but the notion is protecting human dignity is important enough that you go against other religious notions. The human being deserves to have dignity. And then he discusses the Septuagint of the Vulgate. I'll leave it to those of you who know either Greek and Latin that can make some sense out of it. Alright. But here's the key thing. The brute's existence is undignified, is an undignified one, because he is helpless existence. Human existence is dignified once, is a dignified one, because it is a glorious, majestic, powerful existence. Hence, dignity is unobtainable as long as man has not reclaimed himself in coexistence with nature, that has risen from a non-reflective, degradingly helpless, instinctive life to an intelligent, planned, and majestic one. Right? So, man equals dignity, equals glory and majesty. Right, there's no dignity without responsibility, and one cannot assume responsibility as long as he's not capable of living up to its commitments. So on one hand, he has dignity because he controls the environment. If he's helpless, and it's just like every other animal, that's not a dignified existence. On the other hand, you know, being able to control the environment means you have a responsibility with how you do it. The dignity involves, on one hand, mastery and control over something, but it also comes with responsibility. It's not just that I control it, but I have responsibility to use that properly. Only when man rises to the heights of freedom of action and creativity of mind does begin to implement the mandate of dignified responsibility entrusted to him by his maker. So it's the dignity of man expresses itself in the awareness of being responsible and being capable of discharging this responsibility cannot be relieved when he's not gained mastery over the environment. For life embodies in sensate elemental forces is non-responsible, and therefore is undignified. Right? So that, and the footnote talks about a Ramban. That, so we have this dignity of control of nature is something potentially which we have given to us by God, but it's also because we have responsibility. And we can't be responsible if we don't have the power to carry it out. I can only be responsible to accomplish a goal if I have the tools to accomplish it. If I don't have the capacity to accomplish something, how can I be responsible to do it? Sometimes we're asked to do something, we can't do it, we don't have the skills. And it's not our fault though when we're not accomplishing the goal. We don't have the skills to do it, of course we can't accomplish the goal. But the fact is that we can. Man of old who could not fight disease and succumbed in multitude to yellow fever, any other plague, degrading helplessness, cannot lay claim to dignity. Only the man who builds hospitals, discovers therapeutic techniques, and saves lives is blessed with dignity. And he said, well, talk about the fact, everything, the fact that it took us a long time to get from one place to the other. So we're not connected. We have greater control now. We can get there by plane. We can get there in a very short time. I was not aware of all the way in the airports. But the idea is, to the degree that we have greater knowledge, power, skills, then we can accomplish things accordingly and fulfill our responsibilities, and we're more dignified. Hence, Adam the First is aggressive, bold, and victory-minded. His motto is success, triumph over the cosmic forces. Right? He engaged in creative work, trying to imitate his maker, Imitatio Dei, which, by the way, is often explained in different terms, in terms of having proper midos and Hashem visits of Avram when he's recuperating from the pain of the surgery for the bris milah. So just like Hashem is mevaka chol, and we should be mevaka chol. But the Rav sees it in the notion of God being all powerful and able to do everything. We have within us a miniature of that capacity. Right? The most characteristic example of Adam the First is the mathematical scientist who whisks away from the array of tangible things, from color and sound, from heat, touch, and smell, to our senses, to a formal relationship world of thought constructs. The paroxysm is arbitrary postulating, spontaneous positing, and deducing. All right, so this is an interesting question, which is not necessarily a religious question. The question is whether the scientific and mathematical models truly correspond to reality. Right? In real life, are there any perfect circles? Are there any real triangles? Or it's only approximations, statistical stuff. So this is, if you're interested in philosophy of science, you can pursue this. But the bottom line is that human beings can create this model. Right? The reality is part of nature. The model that we can manipulate is that which comes from human scientific knowledge. I'm going to end. I'm going to tell you momentarily, right? Adam the First is not only a creative theoretician; he's also a creative aesthete. He fascinates with his mind and beauty with his heart. Shows both intellectual and aesthetic creativity, pride. The concept of beauty. Man can create beauty to become an artist, whether it's in literature or art or music, he can create beautiful things. Now, the importance of beauty is interesting, because the footnote is he refers to the famous understanding of the Rambam of the first chait of Adam HaRishon, is that he went from a world of good and bad to a world of pleasant and unpleasant, where it was his conscience energized not only by that of good but that of the beautiful. His mind is questing not for the true but the pleasant and functional, which is rooted in the aesthetical and not noetic ethical sphere. Now, I'm going to stop on this phrase, noetic, which has to do with the technical term. But the Rav is very much interested, on one hand, in the ethical, which he sees as connected with the intellectual ethical, and on the other hand, with the technological use of intellect that's associated with beauty. And the first is, even though we think that as a religious personality we're interested in the ethical dimension, we're interested in the not getting close to Hashem, he said, but Adam, we one is fulfilling what the Pasuk tells them to do. It's not just something of modern man doing it on its own. It's the mitzvah that was given to Adam 1. Right? In doing all this, Adam the First is trying to carry out the mandate entrusted to him by his Maker, who at the dawn of the sixth mystery day of creation, to man and said, fill the earth and subdue it. It is God who decreed that the story of Adam 1 be the great saga of freedom of man slave, who gradually transforms himself to man master. While driven by energy cannot but obey, Adam the First transcends the limits of the reasonable and probable to the open space of a boundless universe. Right? And even this longing for vastness, no matter how adventurous and fantastic, is legitimate. When the Rub was not bothered, going into the heavens, it's God's domain, no. Man's ability to reach out is what is a God-given quality given to man. However, stars acting in harmony with his nature, manifestation of obedience rather than rebellion against God. Some we have acclaimed found triple equation: humanity equals dignity, equal responsibility, equal majesty. But then you're going to see that when you get to Adam 2, everything is changing. It's completely different. It's not to conquer, it's not to win, it's not to build, it's much more internal. Well, we'll get to that in the next week.